then let's cultivate our motivation and feel pleased that we have this opportunity, which is actually quite rare, to listen to the Dharma and to have a strong determination to really take the most out of this experience. And we do that by enlarging the capacity of our motivation so that we're not just seeking our own benefit, either worldly or spiritual, but really seeking the long-term benefit of all sentient beings. In fact, aspiring to become a Buddha ourselves so that we can be of the most effective benefit to them. So this kind of motivation, let's listen to and then discuss the teachings today. So I thought today to just kind of give an overview with some background information about the whole paradigm and worldview within which we're working as Buddhists. Because our usual cultural and ignorant worldview is that here's me, I'm me, I'm sitting here, everything else is out there. My goal is to get happiness for myself and avoid suffering. And so anything I can get that's good for me, I'll get. Anything that interferes, I'll push it away. When I die, well, death will happen later, or maybe it won't even happen to me. We'll worry about that later because there's probably nothing after it. Yeah, that's kind of our worldview. You know, how we live our life. It's all based on this view of a very solid me at the beginning. And we don't question who this me is, who this I is, that this entire worldview is based on. If we start to examine, you know, and ask, okay, what is the I? What is the self? What is the person? Yeah. What do we say? You know, we usually say, this is me. This is me. I'm here because this body's here. Are you your body? Yeah? If somebody's body is there, does that mean they're there? What happens when it's a dead body? You don't think the person's there then, but the body's there. So is the body the person? Yeah? So what is this person that we're, you know, so preoccupied with? It's not the body. On the other hand, it's not totally different from the body either, is it? Because we only kind of can recognize that there's a person there by seeing the body or having some contact, you know, with the mind. And when we say, who am I, when we sit there very quietly and say, who am I? You know, is it our body asking, who am I? Is it your brain? Is it your the blips and the, you know, the electrons and chemicals in the brain that's asking the question, who am I or what am I? Is it the, are your happiness and suffering just... you know, the configuration of the atoms and molecules in the brain? Yeah. Who is this thing that's feeling happiness and suffering? Yeah. So we see that it's not the body, but it's also not separate from the body. There's in the sense that, you know, we tell there's a person there by also seeing their body. What we call the person, you know, the person is what's merely labeled in dependence upon the body and the mind together, a combination of the body and mind. So it's not the body that depends on the body. The person is not the mind, but it also depends on the mind. Okay. So then we get into the question, well, what's our mind? And that's a great question to make a scientist nervous, because it can tell you lots about the body, but very little about the mind. You know? And even us, if we ask, what is our mind? What do we come up with? You know? Just our normal usage of the word mind. Somebody has a good mind. What's that mean? Yeah? Or somebody's mindless. What's that mean? Or they're mindful. What's that mean? You know? All this way that we use the word mind, what is this mind? Okay? So from a Buddhist viewpoint, first of all, the word heart and mind is the same word in Buddhist vocabulary. So it's not like Western heart, mind and heart and brick wall in between them. Okay. It's the same word for mind and heart. And mind doesn't mean the brain, because the brain's part of the body. Okay. The mind is something formless. And the mind isn't just the intellect. Yeah, it's not just the intellect. It's not just the cognitive powers. It's not just our emotions. Sometimes we think of heart, we think of the emotions. It's not just the emotions. But what we call mind is actually all of those things. Anything that is cognitive, anything that has the ability to reflect and engage and know objects. That's what we call the mind. So it can include somebody's intellectual abilities, it can include their cognitive abilities, you know, we can see, hear, smell, taste, touch, those things, think about stuff. We have emotions. We have feelings of pleasure, pain, neutral. We have all different sorts of mental factors, you know, that discern objects and, you know, so on and so forth. So the mind, when we say the word mind, it includes all these kinds of things that have in common two qualities. One is that they're clear, and the other is that they're aware or knowing. So clear can mean either formless, or it can mean clear in the sense of ability to reflect objects. And then knowing or awareness, the second quality of mind, is the ability to engage in objects. So when you look, when you feel inside, when you say, I'm sitting here, okay? When we say, I'm sitting here, well, what's actually sitting here is the body, yeah? But what's the feeling component, the thing that makes us, that makes this body a live organism? That's the mind, or the heart, or the consciousness. Okay? And that mind is something that we can't see with scientific instruments. You know, because scientific instruments measure things that, you know, are atomic and molecular in nature, and the consciousness, the mind, isn't. But it still exists. In other words, not everything that exists is composed of atoms and molecules. Now, we happen to be very almost reductionist, you know. If it exists, you've got to measure it. Yeah, but there's lots of things that exist without, you know, being atomic in structure. Is education made of atoms and molecules? Is democracy made of atoms and molecules? Huh? So you see, you know, there's so many things that aren't molecular, but they exist. Okay? So some of those things are consciousness, some of them, you know, or another category that we call abstract composites. But the idea is that there's more than just the body that exists. Okay? So science knows one aspect of reality, and in Buddhism we're trying to enlarge upon that and know the more personal, cognitive, experiential aspect of reality. Science can measure that through seeing the outward manifestations. You know, they can measure what's happening in the brain, which is an external manifestation of what's happening in the mind. But those things are not the mind. Yeah. Because you wouldn't put a bunch of synapses on the table and say, oh, that's happiness, would you? Yeah. Okay. So maybe happiness is related to what's happening in your brain synapses. But the brain synapses, all that chemical, electrical stuff, that's not happiness. Yeah. Okay. The same way if you put, it's very funny, when at one of these Mind and Life conferences, there was one scientist who was quite reductionist, and you know, everything has to be measurable by science and has to be material in nature. And His Holiness said, if you put somebody's brain out on the table, would you have the feeling that there was a person there? What do you think? You know, you walked in the room, if you walked in here, you know, and there's a bunch of brains sitting on these tables. Would you say, oh, all the monks and nuns are here today? Yeah. A lot of people listening to teachings. There's a bunch of brains, maybe a few ears. You know, they're all listening to teachings. Yeah, we wouldn't think that, would we? Yeah. We used to also joke about the scientist, you know, when he went home at night. If his wife said, I love you, dear, he would probably say, okay, I've got to take your, you know, your galvanic skin response and check how much dopamine you have in your synapses, because that's the only way I'm going to know if you love me. You know, got to measure it scientifically. Yeah. So, science is quite wonderful, but you know, it needs to expand to really know what the mind is. This whole cognitive experiential part of us. Okay? And so that's the primary thing that Buddhism is concerned about. So when we say I or me or person or Joe or, you know, Harriet or whoever it is, we're always giving the label of a person independence upon a combination of body and mind. That's how we know the person. But neither the body nor the mind is the person. Okay? But the person's not separate from them. But it's not the same thing as them. So it's interesting to think about and ask ourselves, you know, whenever I say I, what exactly am I referring to? When you say, I'm walking, what are you referring to? Body. When you say, I'm thinking. Mind. I'm feeling happy. Your body feels happy?
Well, just having any physical sensations that accompany emotions.
Okay. So there's physical sensations. Yeah. But are the the happiness you get from those sensations, is that happiness the body or the mind?
It's dependent upon both, I would say. I don't think it's either one or the other.
So you don't think your happiness is part of the mind?
Oh, I think it's dependent upon both.
But it's separate from them?
No, it's not separate either.
When we look at the we talk about the five aggregates of body and mind, Okay? So we talk about the body, that's the form. And then we talk about four mental aggregates. Aggregate means heap. And so these are the the factors of, you know, which compose a person. So the body, and then there's four mental aggregates. One is feeling, which refers to pleasurable, painful, and neutral feeling. The other one is discriminations or discernments, so we can identify things. Then there's one that's called conditioning factors or conditioned factors, and these are all the other mental factors, different, you know, it could be anger, it could be faith, you know, all these different kinds of emotions that we have, and also including all other sorts of abilities that we have, of analysis or investigation or sleep or, you know, attention, intention, those are all mental factors. And then the fifth that fall into this one of conditioned factors. And then the fifth aggregate is consciousness, which is referring just to the primary minds. In other words, the visual consciousness that sees color and shape, the auditory consciousness, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, and then mental consciousness. So we have six consciousnesses. And they just determine the general field of our cognition, and then feeling and discrimination and conditioning factors help out the consciousness, fill in the different abilities so that the consciousness becomes a whole. Okay? So when we're talking about pain, pleasure, and neutral feelings, what is that? Which aggregate is it going in? It's going in the feeling aggregate. So some of the pain, pleasure, and neutral, they may be caused or associated with the body. But the feeling of pain, pleasure, neutral, it's experienced by the mind, because if the mind is absent, the body itself doesn't experience that. And it's quite interesting when you're even experiencing a sensation, like, your knee hurts or something like that, okay? And to say, what is it actually? What is this sensation? Is this sensation my knee? Is the knee alone feeling this? In other words, absent the mind, would the knee feel this pain? Yeah? It feels like it, but when you actually ask yourself, it's like, no. Yeah, the dead body doesn't have aching knees. Yeah? And so, you know, what's actually experiencing this sensation? What's actually experiencing it? It feels like it's there in the body, but when we actually look at our experience, is the sensation itself out there, physically in the body? Yeah? And when we talk, it's interesting to look, we'll talk about even something like roughness and smoothness, and we say, oh, that's the quality of an object. Yeah? Something is rough, the cloth is rough, the cloth is smooth. You know, it's an attribute of that object. But when you really do that, and you rub yourself, rub your fingers against something, it's interesting to say, well, where exactly is that smoothness? Or where exactly is that roughness? Is it really there in the object? Or doesn't it also depend on the mind cognizing that? You know? I mean, is it smooth without anybody cognizing smoothness? Yeah? And where is that sensation that we feel? It's interesting, isn't it? You know, because you really see, you know, even something that's that basic as feeling roughness and smoothness is dependent on the mind. We wouldn't know these qualities otherwise, and how, you know, it's like the mind, there's this experiential aspect that knows these qualities. Otherwise, you know, what are they? Do you see what I mean? Yeah? So it's quite interesting, yeah?
Buddhist psychotherapist Harvey Erickson read an article about, and he may be defining feelings a little differently, but he was talking about how he was making a division between feelings being physical sensations of muscle tension or whatever, and emotions being an interpretation of those, of those physical sensations, which is what I would say was both, but I don't know if you can maybe, if that paradigm works, do you think, in the way you're presenting it?
Yeah, it could work in the sense that we have pleasurable, painful, and neutral feelings, and then we react emotionally to those feelings. Okay, so the pleasure, pain, neutral falls in the feeling aggregate. Then if it's pleasurable, we react with attachment. If it's painful, we react with animosity, aversion. If it's neutral, we react with ignorance.
But he was calling those feelings physical sensations, which you're saying they're not.
Well, we call them physical. Pleasure, pain, and neutral are definitely feelings. They're not physical sensations. When you classify feelings, there's one kind of feelings that come from the body and one kind of feelings that come from the mind. But they're both in the feeling aggregate. They're not in the body aggregate.
That's where the confusion is coming from.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not in the body aggregate. Because the sensations have to, the pleasure, the roughness, smoothness, we put in the physical, you know, form aggregate. But the pleasure we get from experiencing that goes in the feeling aggregate. But when you really look and you're, you know, okay, this is smooth, well, where exactly is this smoothness? It's quite interesting, you know, sit there and meditate with it. Where exactly is this smoothness? Is it there in the object? Is it in my fingers? Is it in my mind? That is quite interesting. Just to watch that. What is that?
You don't feel smoothness unless you move your finger. You just touch something, you don't really feel that.
Yeah. You might feel the temperature.
Yeah, but there isn't the sensation of smooth and rough comes from a,
movement. Very true.
What about taking, like, it seems like there's a lot of variance in this example of smooth and rough, you know, and at what point does something become smooth and at what point does it become rough? But then if you were to take something like this color, blue, and I would say, oh, well, that's blue. But then, you know, someone from a different culture or a different whatever came and designated this as red, we could still have some authority in saying, well, no, that's a false perception. This is actually blue. So, how does that work in terms of...
Well, you know, if somebody else came and said it's red, yeah, if red, the sound red, is a translation of the English word blue, then you could say it's red. You know, if they're speaking English... Yeah, then you could say no, you know, because there's a reliable cognizer that says no, it's not red, it's blue, okay? But the word blue isn't inherently associated with that color. Yeah, that color could have different shades. What also I find interesting is even you look outside of the tree and we say, oh, that's green. But when you look, there's many different colors of green. Yeah? And if you look at one leaf, in some light, it's one color. In another light, it's another color. And yet we keep saying it's green, but actually it's different colors depending upon what the light is. You know, it could be light green or dark green or... Yeah? It's quite interesting, and just how we label things in this whole process. It's green. What in the world does that mean? Yeah. Especially because if you're ever here in the winter, remember the first winter we were here, Venerable Jigme, I was in India. She was here a couple of days. She took some pictures and sent them to me. And I wrote back and I said, oh, could you please send them in color, send color photos. And they were color photos, but it's just in the winter, the green needles look dark. Yeah. And I didn't recognize them as green. I'm sure the color didn't change. But the lighting sure changed. Yeah. Enough that I thought she was sending me a black and white photo. Okay. Anyway, back to this thing of body and mind, yeah, that we're a combination of the body and mind. And then we have to ask ourselves, okay, if what the I is what's merely labeled in dependence upon the body and mind, then, you know, what is this body, what is this mind, and what is this person, you know? What is their relationship between these three things? So the body is physical in nature, like I was saying, made of atoms and molecules. The mind is not physical in nature, and it has cognitive ability. Okay? So these two things, body and mind, when we're alive, it's because these two things have some relationship. Okay? And so we become an embodied being, and the I is labeled upon this combination, and these two things are interacting, because what happens in our body influences our mind. What happens in our mind influences our body. Yeah, if your body feels sick, your mind gets in a bad mood. But if your mind is in a bad mood, your body often feels worse. Yeah, okay, so it goes back and forth. Yeah, okay, but in general, so they're relating to each other when we're alive. But they also have distinct continuities because they have distinct natures. One is atomic, one isn't. So the body, which is atomic, has its own set of causes and its own set of effects. Okay, so if we look at what caused this body, now what do we point to? What caused this body? Where'd your body come from? Hmm?
Sex.
Yeah.
Sperm and egg.
Yeah. It's from the sperm and egg of our parents, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so it's not just the sperm and egg, it's also everything we ate since then, all the nourishment that we've eaten, all of that becomes part of the cause of the body. Okay, so if we look, the body is physical in nature and its causes are also physical. Okay, all the food we've eaten, the sperm and egg of our parents, and then, you know, what was it before that? It was, you know, the food was all dirt, basically, wasn't it? Dirt or water or, you know, sunshine. And the sperm and egg of our parents was made up of that same material. So, you know, it all came from organic material. Yeah. When the body of this life dies, then what happens? You know? It just disintegrates, doesn't it? It's an organic thing, and it disintegrates, and it becomes, it's a dead corpse, and then it breaks up, and the flesh dissolves, and the muscles dissolve, and eventually the bones dissolve, and eventually there's nothing left. We're just, the body's completely recycled in nature. Yeah. Have the worms have a nice lunch. Make offering to all the worms. Yeah, that's all. It's true, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, we treasure this body and take such good care of this body, but basically it came from earth and it goes back into the earth and that's it. Okay. Now our consciousness, on the other hand, you know, we can't say that it came from the earth because it's not molecular. It doesn't go back to the earth because it's not molecular. So if we look at one moment of mind or consciousness, okay, it depended upon the previous moment of consciousness that was before it. Wake up. Oh, where's my squirt gun. I've got to get bring my squirt gun in. The mind, yeah, our mind of one moment came from the mind of the previous moment, which came from the mind of the moment before that. There's some kind of continuity of consciousness or continuity of mind, isn't there? Okay. So today's mind from, or you could say this moment's mind from the previous moment's mind from the previous moment's mind, or if you count it in bigger chunks, today's mind came from yesterday's mind and from the day before yesterday's mind, or if you count it in bigger chunks, this year's mind from last year's mind. In any case, we see that there's a continuity of consciousness. Yeah? And we get to a point where we can't remember anything. Yeah? How old were you? What's your first memory? How old were you? Yeah? Three?
17.
What? 17. 17. Oh. So we may not, we come to a point where we can't remember being younger, but we know that, for example, a one-month-old baby has mind. Yeah, because we look at one-month-old babies, and even though we can tell they have mind and they're living beings, they're not going to remember what's happening to them right now. Okay, so babies had minds. Then what about in the womb? Okay, where the baby's mind came from the previous moment, from the previous moment. Okay, so it goes back into the womb as well. You know, there's consciousness present. So from a Buddhist viewpoint, I mean, of course, that consciousness isn't the same as our consciousness now. It doesn't know language. It doesn't have all the sense faculties functioning and so on. But there's still awareness in the womb. Then you trace it back, yeah, to the time of conception. From a Buddhist viewpoint, this is generally when, you know, the sperm, the egg, and the consciousness come together is the time of conception. So the sperm and egg, we know where they came from. Where did that consciousness come from? What was the previous cause of that first moment of consciousness in this life? You know, did it come out of nowhere? Did the stork bring it? Is it a byproduct of the sperm and egg? Yeah. Where did it come from? Yeah. Well, until then, every single moment of mind, you know, came from a preceding moment. So if you get back to that time of conception, you say, well, that moment, first moment of mind in this life, came from the, you know, a previous moment of mind. So then it means that there was consciousness, there was life before this particular life. And then similarly, you know, that moment of mind that preceded the time of conception in this moment, in this life, had a previous moment. And it goes, we have the continuity of consciousness going back beginninglessly. Yeah, with each moment of mind being produced by a previous moment of mind. Okay, you with me? Kind of. Well, if you look at material things, each moment depends on a previous moment of material, right? So the scientists may trace things back to, let's say, the Big Bang. But was there something existing before the Big Bang? There had to be, don't you think? Because something can't just appear out of nothing. So there was some kind of physical material, might have been very subtle material, yeah, that existed before the Big Bang, and the moment before that and the moment before that. So there's an infinite regression of moments of atoms. So same, you know, or physical material, whatever, you know, could be energy or atomic or whatever falls in that scope. Then the same thing with the mind. Each moment of mind came up from preceding moment. Yeah. You get to conception, preceding moment, So then there's consciousness that was in a previous life, yeah, that died from that previous life, went into, there's an intermediate stage, and then came into this life, okay, hooked up with this sperm and egg. Okay? So if we look back, you know, there's just one moment of mind preceding another moment of mind, and there's infinite regression there. You can't say there was a first moment. Okay? Now, why can't you say there's a first moment? Because our mind likes to have a first moment, doesn't it? You know, especially you grew up with the Bible, you know, in the beginning. Yeah. But look at it this way. Do you remember math class? Where whatever number you stand on, either way you look, there's infinite numbers in each way. Whether you stand on minus 569 or plus 5,648, there's infinite numbers either way on the number line, isn't there? Yeah. You never reach a beginning or an end to the number line. Never. Never. Yeah. Why? Because there's always something before it. There's always something after it. The idea being here, okay, is that things that are caused, you know, things that function, that change, how is it that they function and change and exist? It's because they had causes. Okay? So if something had a cause, then, you know, okay, then we look at that cause. Well, how did that cause come to be? Did it appear out of nowhere? Did it appear without a cause? No, it too had a cause. So if you look in the garden, okay, you know, we have some lettuce. The lettuce came from its cause, the lettuce seeds, okay, and the dirt. And everything. Where did that lettuce seed come from? Did it just come out of nowhere? Spontaneous appearance? No. You know, there were lettuce plants beforehand. Weren't they? Have you ever seen lettuce go to seed?
Yeah.
So it must produce seeds. Okay, so then you have this infinite regression. So of course you can fit Darwin right into here because, you know, things change and it's not that lettuce always has to be lettuce. You know, the RNA and DNA and stuff in the lettuce can change and so on. But you have some kind of continuity there. In other words, anything that exists and changes and functions, arose due to its own particular causes and conditions. You know, nothing arises causelessly. Yeah. If things could arise causelessly, we wouldn't need to cook to have lunch. Yeah, because cooking is the cause of having lunch. So you wouldn't need to shop or cook or grow anything in order to have lunch because lunch could appear without causes. No, that's not going to work. Okay, so there's a couple of rules here, you know. The functioning things have to have causes. They don't just come out of nowhere. Okay. And second is that cause needs to correspond to the result in some way. The lettuce didn't arise because we planted pomegranate seeds, okay, or because we planted lemon seeds. Lemon seeds, pomegranate seeds, don't have the ability to produce lettuce. So the cause of something has to be a cause that corresponds with that result. It can't just be any old cause. Yeah. And then things depend not only on causes and on their own unique causes, but also on conditions. In other words, it's not sufficient just to have one thing that causes the next moment. But there's other things that influence, you know, that make that cause change in a particular way. In other words, it's not like you have one kind of fixed cause here that is pre-programmed, you know, with no outside influence to become anything. Because actually, if you pre-programmed it, it means that there was an outside influence, doesn't it? Yeah. So there's causes and conditions, because you need those conditions to make the principal causes change to become what the new thing's going to be. And if the conditions aren't there, then that cause isn't going to change into that exact thing. Okay? So we have knapweed seeds in the ground in winter, but they don't grow. Yeah. Why? Because there's not enough heat and water. So you need those cooperative conditions of heat and water for the knapweed to grow. Okay. Yeah.
Taking the example of the lettuce leaf, mm-hmm. and on an evolutionary scale, like, you know, this one strand of lettuce can change into all these different varieties mm-hmm. because of the variation within the DNA and the RNA and so mm-hmm. forth. Similarly, if we were to take that and apply it to this, the notion of mind,
mm-hmm.
One thing that's talked about in terms of refuting reincarnation is that I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember my previous life. And I don't know, there's a part of me that's kind of struggling with that, because it seems like, you know, if someone learns something at the age of 15 about mathematics, you know, then at the age of 80, they're going to be able to retrieve that. And there's this huge...
Yeah, I don't remember my high school math now.
Then I guess kind of the nature of the question is, in the next life,
mm-hmm.
is the dispositions we have and certain mental acuities and so forth, is that related to previous lifetimes? Like similarly, like the whole tuku aspect,
mm-hmm.
you know, that not necessarily are they the same person and they have these, but that they're kind of, they have a certain capability to pick mm-hmm. things up. And does that make sense
yeah.
at all then?
Yeah, yeah. So you're asking in terms of the consciousness. Yeah, just as we saw that the lettuce has its own unique qualities, the lettuce seed to produce lettuce plant. Yeah, so and the qualities of the lettuce plant depends upon what was there in the lettuce seed.
But also that the lettuce over time has changed and has been modified. Similarly, does the
right.
mind also have those qualities?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the ability of the mind to change and modify. The mind can be born in one realm, one lifetime, another realm, another lifetime. So it changes and modifies. You know, Achi, our kitty, yeah, we're praying for him to be a human being. Manju too, you know, in their future lives. Yeah. So, you know, that what is a kitty mind now, when they lose the kitty aggregates, that continuity of clarity and awareness... You know, if they have good cooperative conditions, if we're saying prayers and they've managed to create some good karma and so on, then maybe, you know, their mind will be attracted to a human rebirth and have the predispositions to want to come to the Abbey, you know, in their next life. So look out for them. Yeah. If we have a little 3-year-old kid who wants to come and sit in the kitty box, you know, the little thing that I should not curl up in, then, well, they recognize their thing from previous life. Yeah, we'll find a little 3-year-old curled up in the foot of Venerable Senkei's bed. Waking her up at 3:00 in the morning. Yeah, so I'm joking. But yeah, you know, there's certain qualities or tendencies that can come with the mind from one lifetime to the next. Of course, they're not exactly alike as they were in the previous life. But even in one lifetime, are the qualities that we have ever exactly alike from one moment to the next? No, they're changing all the time. You know, we say, oh, somebody has such and such a kind of personality. But does that mean that they're always that way? No, not at all. Yeah, and all those habits can change and become different things. And each moment of mind is something separate. Okay? So what we do this life can influence and condition, you know, future lives. But it's also, you know, different. Okay? For example, when I gave a talk about rebirth in southern Florida about 20 years ago, and one woman came up to me afterwards, and an elderly woman, and she said, oh, that was really helpful. I understand my son now. Because nobody in our family was musically inclined. And yet from the time when he was a baby, when he was really young, you know, we would get in like a taxi or go somewhere and they would be playing classical music and he would know it. And he could identify it and he could hum along with it. And she said, we never taught him. But when you talk about rebirth, well, okay, maybe in a previous life he had some familiarity with music. You know, those imprints, that attraction was there. And so, now most of you don't have kids. Some of you do. You have kids. You have any kids now? There's two of you have children. Unless some others of you were hiding out. Yeah. But, you know, any parent will tell you that their kids are not born the same. Yeah, they have different personalities and they have habits from the time they're born. You know, they don't come in as blank slates. Yeah, but there's habits and dispositions there. So, you know, these kinds of tendencies come from either habits and tendencies in previous lives, or they might be conditioned also by the karma, you know, the tendency to do that kind of action again and again. Yeah. So you have things like that. So the person of the previous life isn't the same as the person in this life. The consciousness of the previous life is not the same as the consciousness of this life. But they aren't totally unrelated because they are related in that one's a cause and one's an effect. Okay? Yeah?
This is kind of related to external influence on the continuity of mind. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about kitties mm-hmm. and saying prayers for them, mm-hmm. and similarly we say prayers for people, and when people die we say prayers for their... Mm-hmm. Good rebirth and such. I wonder how prayer and other things like that can actually influence something that. Mm-hmm. Because it's my understanding that basically the imprints have to be on your own mind. So right. Even if you're saying prayers for me that I don't hear you and I don't read your lips, how does that affect me at all?
Okay, so how can prayers affect somebody else if. You know, you're not in physical contact with them and you don't even know that they're praying for you or anything like that.
Because obviously you can't like take away anyone's karma, you can't. Right. So how does anything really affect the subtlest level that is moving on?
Right. So it's the same idea, I think, of causes and conditions in that somebody has to have certain karmic seeds planted in their mind already. But for those seeds to ripen at a particular time, one of the conditions, not the only condition, but one condition could be the force of prayer, the force of aspiration, in the sense that it puts a good energy, you know, vibration around that person that allows, it's like adding the water and the heat to a physical seed that allows it to grow. This kind of dedication and so on can, you know, affect others that way. So it's on a subtle level because, you know, we always think of, you know, the only way we communicate is, you know, call each other up. But I think there could be all sorts of other more subtle ways of communicating so that if somebody is praying for you, that, you know, it can influence your mind. But for to have a good rebirth, you know, let's say, you need to also have created the karma and have the principal karmic seed that would ripen in that way. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is the animal realm the hardest realm to get out of?
Is the animal realm the hardest realm to get out of? I would say no.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Because we talk about different realms of existence. There's the animal realm, which we can see. There's also a realm called the hungry ghosts, which they're not really ghosts. The Sanskrit term is preta, and there's not a really good English term for it. But they're beings who suffer from intense dissatisfaction and always hungry and always thirsty. And it's interesting, you can see some people, okay, not just the people who overeat, but, you know, some human beings who always are running from one thing to another, never finding any satisfaction, you know, going from one relationship to the next relationship to the next relationship, or one, you know, high to another high to another high, never finding satisfaction. So that state of mind, yeah, creates the cause, you know, it's related to the hungry ghost rebirth. You know, the actual causes are things like stealing, for example, would make one be reborn as a hungry ghost. So you have that realm. Then you also have a hellish realm where beings suffer from a lot of physical pain, and that's very related to the mind of anger. You know, the mind of anger is burning, isn't it? Yeah, and a very painful mind, and it creates an external painful environment and a painful body. And then we also have two other realms that are considered higher or more pleasurable than ours. One is called the demigod realm or asura realm, and these are beings who have higher pleasure than we do, but they also suffer from a lot of jealousy. Because there's not just them, there's the gods, and the gods have even more pleasure. Okay? And then amongst the realms of the gods, there's the gods that have pleasure due to sense pleasure, kind of like, you know, Beverly Hills Deluxe. Yeah. Or there's other realms of gods where one gets reborn there due to different meditative ability, having actualized different levels of samadhi. Okay? So, you know, our mind can vary greatly according to the body and the realm in which it takes rebirth. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So is it harder though, because you're purifying in the hell realms or the hungry ghost realms, but mm-hmm. it's hard to purify if you're always trying, you have the propensity to kill.
Okay.
Like,
yeah. Well, the beings in the lower realms aren't actually purifying. They're experiencing the result of their karma. Purification only comes about when we have a conscious intention that we're purifying.
Okay,
so for example, somebody could be experiencing pain as a human being, and they're just experiencing the result of their karma. So that karma is getting used up, it's bearing its result. But somebody who knows how to work with their mind, when they experience pain, then they say, oh, this is the result of my karma. I'm going to really learn from this and try not to do any more harmful actions in the future. Or they might think, by my experiencing this suffering, may I take on the suffering of other living beings. Or they may do a purification practice, regretting, you know, it may spur them to regret their previous misdeeds. So with that kind of conscious intention of how you change your mind in reaction to the suffering, that's what makes a purification or not.
You don't have that consciousness.
And with the hell beings, you know, unless you're a pretty exceptional hungry ghost who might think, you know, I'm purifying my negative karma. I mean, maybe such beings exist. There's always that kind of possibility. They talk about the Buddha in a previous life when he was born in a hell realm, and he thought, you know, he was pulling this this cart that was burning and flaming with another person. They were yoked together, and he thought, may I take on all the suffering of this other person? So, you know, for somebody who has a lot of strong seeds for virtue, maybe that can happen in that kind of realm. Yeah. But in terms of the kiddies, you know, we're planting seeds by them hearing the prayers and so on. Yeah. But I think the main cause for a good rebirth will have to be a seed that they've created, you know, themselves. And then hearing the prayers, hearing all the teachings, you know. Yeah. They'll know the food offering prayer very well. And the dedication, they hear that one, you know, several times a day. And yeah. So that plants good seeds, which, you know, will help them in their future. But they probably need another kind of karma that will actually create the cause for the human rebirth. Yes, yeah.
I'm just always a little curious where names like Nagas and Garudas and so forth fit in this long. I never figure it out. Are they animals? Are they like gods?
So in the scriptures they mention these kind of animals or beings that we can't necessarily see with our eyes. Nagas, I think they put those mostly in the animal realm. But there can be very intelligent Nagas. Garudas, I have no idea where they put realm. I don't know.
What's up on them?
I don't know. Okay. So, but the, yeah?
Can you relate this discussion of the mind to Buddha nature?
Okay, so to relate this discussion of the mind to Buddha nature. Okay. When we talk about Buddha nature, there's two aspects of it. One is called the naturally abiding Buddha nature, and that refers to the emptiness of inherent existence of the mind. Okay? So the mind always is empty of inherent existence. Okay? So that Buddha nature is always there, because the mind, no matter what form it's in, always is empty of inherent existence and exists dependently. Okay. Then the other aspect of Buddha nature is called transforming Buddha nature. And this is any aspect of us that has the ability to transform and be enhanced and become a quality of the Buddha. So, for example, the mental factor of compassion that we have now, that, you know, is part of the transforming Buddha nature. The kiddies probably have some mental factor of compassion.
Absolutely.
Yeah, in a kitty mind. Yeah, they care about each other, don't they?
Yeah, definitely not show compassion to the mind. One time I stepped on mom, and he made a sound, and Ash came over and checked him out very much caring.
Yeah. So you can see there's some kind of, you know, mental factor of compassion there and care. So, you know, that is part of what can be enhanced and can continue on to Buddhahood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Or just the clear and knowing nature of the mind. You know, because it's not exactly the same mind in each lifetime. Could be an animal mind, a human mind, a God mind, okay? But there's a continuity between all these lives. But there's nothing permanent that goes from one life to the next. So there's not like there's any kind of essence of mind or essence of the person that, you know, some core that's permanent and unchanging, but then around it, it changes. It's not like that. Yeah.
Okay. So you would say that the transformative Buddha nature would be the clear knowing nature and the love and compassion and so on and so forth.
Right. Right. And so those aspects of the transforming Buddha nature, yeah, they could be you know, maybe more expressive in one lifetime than the other, but they can never completely disappear. So it's impossible to have a person who is 100% without compassion. Such a thing doesn't exist. Okay? There's always the potential, the seed of the compassion in that person's mind. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I've struggled with this. I've asked somebody else, and I don't know the response, unfortunately, but they don't understand if there's absolutely no essence to our mind. What does karma attach to? If you don't receive the results of karma immediately, if it's not moment to moment to moment, how is it possible for something that happened so long ago to come back to you and only you?
Yeah.
There is absolutely no...
Right.
You.
Okay. So this question of how does karma go from one life to the next, especially if there's no self, there's no person.
Affect
somebody else. Right?
Yeah.
So this has been the question that has come up since the beginning of Buddhism. Okay, of how does this work, especially if there's no solid self, because we usually think of, okay, there's going to be a solid self, and then the karma just kind of, you know, attaches on here. And then this thing just kind of, you know, it sits on the conveyor belt and it goes from one life to the next. Okay, you know, maybe some karma falls off and some new karma comes on, but there's this still one thing that is permanent and unchanging. Yeah. Or even we might say it changes a little bit, but, you know, it never goes out of existence, and the karmic seeds fall off and jump on, but there's something there that's really unique, you know. Otherwise, why couldn't, you know, somebody else experience the result of my karma? If there's no self, something that's really me, then we could, why not? Why couldn't we experience each other's karma? Yeah. So... The thing is, if there were a self that were unchanging and permanent, it would be impossible to experience the result of karma, because something that is impermanent does not change. It is not affected by causes and conditions. Okay? So if there were a permanent person or a permanent mind, nothing could change. The mind couldn't change. The person couldn't change. It would be frozen in time, immune to causes and conditions. So it's funny because our natural instinct is, or maybe not, well, kind of natural instinct, is there's got to be some permanent there. But if we think about it logically, there can't be. Yeah, because something permanent cannot change. If there's a permanent person, how could it die and be reborn? If there's a permanent person, how can it be angry one moment and happy the next moment? Okay, so if either the person or the mind stream is permanent, then there's no way anything can happen. Okay, that's one aspect. And the other, but our mind says, but there still has to be something there. You know, I'm sure there still has to be something there. You know, something that's really me. You see, this thing is me. It is the essence of me-ness. Yeah. But when you start asking yourself, what is this essence of me-ness, what are you going to point to? What are you going to point to and say, this is the essence of me-ness? Yeah, body goes from one life to the next. Throw that one out. You know, even the body even changes within this life, doesn't it? So the body's not going to be the essence of me-ness. Yeah. So then you say, well, there's some special consciousness. This is what the Chittamadrans say. There's the foundational consciousness. You know, it's impermanent, but it's the essence of me-ness. And it carries all the seeds. Yeah. But how is that something the essence of me-ness? You know?
I kind of picture like a piece of Play-Doh. Barely seen here. but the Play-Doh exists on some level, right? But you can squish it, you can reshape it, you can, all sorts of things can happen to the Play-Doh, so the Play-Doh doesn't look anything like it did before.
Right.
But the Play-Doh's still going from moment to moment. Mm-hmm. And you can stick things in it, things can fall out, and that sort of thing. I guess that's on some level kind of how I...
But is
that's
it...
totally false.
No, the Play-Doh's changing and everything like that. But, yeah, is there something in that lump that is Play-Doh? What makes that lump Play-Doh?
Well, what makes it so that John Pell's Play-Doh doesn't smack into mine? And I guess it's not that I have to label it Play-Doh. Just to understand how our own consequences don't become,
Can I try? Uh-huh. Well, for the Play-Doh, first of all, if you have like a little blue Play-Doh here from this box, you have a piece over here, and you start taking a piece off and putting in another one, and you keep doing that, all of a sudden it's a different, all the substances of that Play-Doh is different from the original Play-Doh. You know, it's kind of like...
Right, but you're saying that there's no original Play-Doh anyway, so I mean, I guess...
Yeah,
I get how... I feel like that supports what I'm saying, not against
it. Well, the original Play-Doh, the Play-Doh you started out with when you looked at that Play-Doh. That Play-Doh was obviously part of something else at some point anyway. But I'm just saying, the Play-Doh is constantly changing, and... You can always put new pieces on it, and eventually you come up with
those
Play-Doh
pieces
that
can't be other people's Play-Doh. That's what's confusing about
right.
it for me. Is I get how the Play-Doh
can be
completely different from life to life, mm-hmm. but I don't get how our Play-Dohs don't collide. Or why
are
you
wouldn't
for somebody else's Play-Doh?
Your Play-Doh's on my...
I've never said Play-Doh so much in my life. You can drop a metaphor.
Going through conditions, though, at least? I mean, like, you wouldn't have your mind the way it is without your mom and your dad, like, teaching you and influencing you and so forth. So... Mm-hmm. aspects of their Play-Doh might influence you, at least through conditions.
Well, and I understand that.
Yes.
I do. But if you kill somebody, mm-hmm. if there's absolutely nothing that connects your karma to... And I'm not going to say...
Oh, no, there is, there
more,
is
right?
something.
I'm talking about like the most subtle essence.
Yeah.
I understand that.
There is something that connects the cause to the result. But that thing is not something that you can find under analysis.
Right.
Okay. It's something that's merely labeled, and we say it's the mere person. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the mere I, the mere person, is simply the person that's labeled independence upon the body and mind. But it's not the body and it's not the mind, and you can't find what exactly this person is and draw a line around it and say, under analysis, I've discovered this is the essence of me-ness. It's only when you don't analyze... When you talk on the conventional level, then you can say, oh, there's a person, there's a continuity. But if you try and find what exactly this thing is, yeah, that's independent of every other factor, then you can't find what it is. Okay? So what we call the person, the mere I, is what carries the karma. But sometimes this mere I is dependent... is labeled independence on five human aggregates, sometimes the four mental aggregates of the formless realm, sometimes, you know, different, this, the extremely subtle mind, sometimes, you know, there's all different bases of imputation for just the mere eye of a single person. Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah. So this mere I, even though you can't find it under ultimate analysis, conventionally on the level of just nominal existence, it carries the karma. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You said the mere I carries the karma. What happens when the mere I ends?
The mere I never ends, because when there's the specific I. And the general I. Okay? So, actually, both of them are still the mere I, but the general I never ends. The specific I, like, you know, Thupten Jampel will end. okay? Because that's the eye of this life. But when we look at your aggregates, we could sometimes say Thubten Jampal, sometimes we could just say that person, you know. And that person doesn't have to be the aggregates of body and mind that's labeled Thubten Jampal. Right now, the specific eye of Jampal and the general eye, you know, they're one nature. That specific eye can die, but the general eye that's labeled on whatever, you know, gross or subtle body and mind are there at the time, that eye continues on. Okay? And so, for example, when the Buddha said, in my previous life, I was born as da-da-da-da-da, there he's talking from the viewpoint of that general eye. It didn't mean that he, Shakyamuni Buddha, was born as the rabbit in the Jataka tales. Okay? It's just there when he says I, it's referring to the general I that spans many, many lifetimes. You know, it's the same way even if you say Katie in this lifetime, what Katie spans many, many mind moments and many moments, you know. There was the baby Katie and the toddler and the, you know, the teenager and the adult and, you know, old person, and they're all going to be called Katie under under that big label. But can you find anything in that that is Katie that's permanent, that's always there? No. Okay. Yeah.
Would you at some point say one life, you're born, is possibly born as a human twice in the same, say you're human and then you're reborn as a human again.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's possible.
Say you're born in the medieval ages.
In the what?
The medieval ages. Uh-huh. And you're good, and you're an archer, and you die. Is it possible to take that affinity for the bow and arrow with you to another life?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there could be certain predispositions or attractions to different things from one life to the next. Like you'll see sometimes little kids who their parents haven't taught them, but they're just naturally, instinctively very kind to animals. And you'll see other kids, and again their parents haven't taught them, who are cruel to animals. Yeah? So we would say this comes from previous imprints. Yeah.
I was going to ask this earlier, but I don't know what I'm talking about. But then when he asked it, it made me think again of the question, can you relate this discussion to the Dalai Lama and how he's one of a sequence of Dalai Lamas?
Yeah.
And is there an original Dalai Lama, or was he from the Buddha? I mean, and how did they identify them?
Yeah. Okay. So the Dalai Lama is basically a social institution. It's a Tibetan creation. Yeah. It's just something the Tibetan culture invented, is the institution of the Dalai Lama. Now, the person who is called the Dalai Lama, you know, until now has been seen as, you know, this general I that has gone from one life to the next, you know, having different names, Sonam Gyatso and Yeshe Gyatso and whatever, you know, Tenzin Gyatso this lifetime. And they, so they often fall under this general category of this general I, but then there's the individual Dalai Lamas and the individual lifetimes there. And, you know, the mind stream that we call the Dalai Lama existed from beginningless time, just like our mind streams exist from beginningless time. And it goes on endlessly, just like our minds will go on endlessly. So what we say the Dalai Lama is just our you know, the Tibetan cultural invention of an institution. Okay? But you can see when they identify, you know, the child, very often the child can recognize people or things from a previous life. We have to end now because so that we can have a little break before your meditation. So let's just sit quietly for a couple of minutes. And then the dedication prayers are on page, what? 37, I think. 39. Okay. So just think a little bit about what you heard. You can remember some of the points and continue thinking. Let's dedicate. Due to this medicine, attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born of no decline, but increase forevermore.